We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Kyle Mabry's at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be looking for your insect pest problems questions, as long as they're in the house. We're not talking about field crops here. We're talking about the house and the yard. And we have as our guest Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist at the U of I, has been with us on this program many times before to answer these questions. And it's been a while since we've talked to him. And we thought, well, we better have him in here. We have an ant problem in our house. Other people probably have problems and they're really not quite sure what to do with them. And we will tell you how to take care of the problem. You tell us what the problem is, and Phil will see if he can help you out. Also, what we're looking for this morning is contributions to the station. We want people to support the station with their dollars. Those are the dollars that help keep us strong and will help keep us on the air in the year to come. Here in the studio with me to encourage people to support the program is Debbie Hamlet. She is our Director of Development. And
pleasure to be here.
Well, we're really happy to have you here. And we're doing something special in this hour.
Yes, we are.
We've done this before, but it's been a while, and it is something that people have gotten excited about.
Yeah.
So let's mention that.
Everybody who calls from, the membership level of $40 or above will receive a book from the Focus Library, and you've got two categories to choose from, fiction or nonfiction. Apparently, this has been very, very popular in the past.
It has, and it's probably been a couple of years since we have done this. We like books. Reading and writers.
Absolutely.
And we have a lot of books that come to us from publishers, hoping that we will interview their writers. And we accumulate them, and occasionally we give them away to people who work here, but we would like listeners to get in on the deal.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't be more specific than either fiction, nonfiction, but we have a lot of good stuff. These are new hardcover books, have mm-hmm. not been read, recently out, and it's just one way we have of saying thanks for
a
pledge.
A good chance to add to your library and to support your public radio station, WILL, who brings you Focus every day, and great authors and interesting topics today, bugs.
Tomorrow the world.
That's right. So call between 11 and 12, and you'll get a book if you pledge $40 or above, and you can do that by calling 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org.
All right. Well, we want to get on to questions here. We have somebody who is ready to go. Let me just give you our phone numbers again. The numbers to call into the show now, that no one will expect you to pledge. It'd be nice if you did, but that's not required. If you want to call and talk to Phil, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. And if you want to send your question by email, you can do that too, will-talk@illinois.edu. Hey, thanks very much for being here. We certainly appreciate
Glad
it.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, here you want to put those on too. And we have somebody all ready to go here in Pisotum, so we'll do that. Line one.
Morning.
Hello. Yeah, hi.
I wanted to get my question in before you start talking because it's always more interesting to listen to you, and then I hesitate to call and interrupt your topics. But anyway, I've got a question about grub control in yards. Does that do damage to earthworms? And then I was curious about the grubs, what pupal stage or larval stage they are. And then my other question is about like the broadband stuff you put around around your house to get earwigs and crickets and stuff like that. Is that a good idea, bad idea? Because I don't like to kill bugs just for bug's sake. But so I guess that's my questions.
Okay. Generally, what we're looking at with the white grubs is that right now we've got the adult beetles poised to come out. We've had reports of Japanese beetle emergence about a week ago in the Collinsville area. We are anticipating their appearance any day now. Probably early part of next week, the first Japanese beetles will be coming out as adult beetles. and they are a problem feeding on trees and shrubs and so on. But they're feeding and mating and laying eggs, and generally what we look at is those plus the mast chafers will be coming out probably in the first week of July is typical for them, and we seem to be pretty close to a normal year after the hot weather, and then the cold weather, you kind of balanced out apparently. So we're anticipating the other June bugs coming out that would lay eggs to make white grubs in July as well. With a situation, if we continue to have a lot of rainfall and turf stays green and nice, even though it's not irrigated, we will probably have fewer white grubs and they will be scattered and may not be at damaging levels. So we're set up right now, unless the weather turns off hot and dry, which my understanding is the long-term predictions are hot and wet. But at any rate, if it turns out hot and dry and non-irrigated areas wilt or turn brownish, go dormant, then the eggs will be concentrated in the turf areas. We recommend application of a long-term insecticide in the month of July, which would be many of your grub materials you got. It may be sold as Merit insecticide. It may be your Scott's product is going to be one of these. It may be sold as Acylipron. There are a variety of brand names out there, and most of them are going to be effective. You look for something that you can apply that will give several weeks of control. It will say so on the bag. There's just so many of them out right now that it's hard to specifically say what you're going to find it under. You can also wait until early August and cut through the turf and pull it back in areas that you tend to have grub problems, even though it's not showing any damage yet, and if you have at least 10 to 12 grubs per foot square, a foot on both sides, two sides, that's going to be enough to cause injury, and then you would use one of those previous insecticides or a material sold as Dilox. This would be triclorphan sold as Dilox, D-Y-L-O-X, and it's a short-lived, short-acting insecticide. You do not apply it during July because it only lasts for 5 days. It can be gone before the eggs hatch, and you get no control. But with the grubs present, you can use that material effectively. We're not likely to see damage until the second half of August through September into October. And so those type of applications will be effective. You would apply those and then water them in with at least a half an inch of irrigation. And this will move the material down into the root zone to provide control for you. So basically through scouting and by watching the weather and so on, you can determine whether you might need to even apply an insecticide to control grubs in any given year. You also asked about applications around the foundation to keep critters from coming in. We look at that as a short-lived type response or answer. It will help keep out earwigs, spiders, crickets, these sorts of things, ants. And this is applied to the foundation to the point of runoff and then lightly dampen the soil next to it. We recommend permethrin, which will many times be sold as a foundation type spray that you can apply. We would prefer a longer term solution, and that involves reducing the amount of dead organic matter next to your foundation. Mulch is a neat thing, but it feeds all kinds of critters that will come into your house and also feed critters that will feed on the critters that come into your house. So the spiders will feed on things living in the mulch and then come into your house. Crickets will feed on the mulch and come into your house. So reducing the dead organic matter, mulch, fallen leaves, this sort of thing next to your foundation, reduces the number of insects next to your house that would come in and thus reduces the number that make it in. And then caulk cracks and crevices in your foundation, typically using a silicone sealer, which will move with the movement of the soil so it doesn't break open real quickly. And this provides not only protection from your critters coming into the house, but also reduces your energy bill by eliminating some of the loss of hot air during the summer, during the wintertime. So this is a good option for you, and this is what we primarily recommend is caulking cracks and crevices, reducing dead organic matter. Spray next to the foundation does provide a barrier for about 30 to 45 days, keeping insects out, but it also kills, as you brought up quite well, a lot of other insects that are out there just doing their thing, living in the mulch, not coming inside, helping break down that mulch. Return nutrients to the soil, be an important part of the ecology, and essentially you're just coming in with a hammer and killing them all. So I guess you can tell from my attitude, that's not what I recommend.
Well, that's my feeling. I have listened to you before and tried to reduce the I've got like rocks right around and try to keep the vegetation mm-hmm. and stuff out of there and the caulking and stuff. But did you say, does the grub control hurt earthworms, though? Is that?
Oh, that's right. You asked about that. Very slightly. Essentially, what happens is it will kill some of the earthworms that are up in the surface soil. So it has little effect on the total earthworm population, the materials that are used today. 20, 30 years ago, we did have some materials that were more toxic to earthworms than ones we have today. After an application, you may see numerous earthworms dead on the surface of the turf, but that is a small fraction, according to research, of what is actually there. What you got were just a few that happened to be up at the surface and got a very heavy dose of the insecticide. Most of them are not particularly toxic to earthworms at a lower level, and these materials do not continue to go through the soil and deeper to where most of your earthworms are living. Particularly and most importantly, the ones that are reproducers tend to be deeper in, particularly of our red worms and so on. Night crawlers, even at this time of the year, the adults have tended to gone down deeper. Unless we've had very heavy rainfall, they'll come out on the surface to mate. So you can impact some of those that are towards the surface, but they tend to be young ones, small ones, not reproducers, and the impact on the total earthworm population is relatively minor.
If it kills the earthworms, if the birds ate those worms, would it have an impact on? I'm not anticipating treating for the grubs anyway. I'm going to wait
okay.
and check, because I saw some early in the spring when I was digging around and gardening and stuff, but I'm going to wait and check on. I just kind of curious about the environmental
yeah.
the toxicity
of these materials to vertebrates, birds, mammals, which includes us, is low enough that any secondary poisoning is very minor. You'd have to have an unusually high earthworm population that got nailed with the insecticide, and then a few robins or something that just literally pigged out on them to get any real effect. It's the carryover effect. This is something that EPA watches for very carefully, and quite frankly, it's very hard for an insecticide to get to the market that has a secondary poisoning concern to any type of vertebrates such as birds. So, no, the likelihood of birds being killed in any, really getting killed at all by feeding on earthworms killed by the insecticide is very small.
Well, great. I hope these weren't inane questions, but
I thought about
it a lot, and I really enjoy it. You're very knowledgeable, and I always like having you guys on, and I enjoyed David's show a lot, so I won't take up any more of your time. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, your questions go along the line of what many people consider and think about and are concerned about, so those are very appropriate questions.
Well, thanks again.
Well, thank you. Other folks, if you have questions about insect problems in the home or in the home landscape, so we're talking about things that maybe attack your ornamental plants or your garden, those sorts of things. Phil Nixon is the guy here to talk with. He's an extension entomologist. He works in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences.
Crop yes? sciences now.
Crop sciences.
Yeah, it's
close enough. Phil, now when are you going to change this now? I'm looking at the page here on the monitor. We always get that wrong. I'm so sorry.
It's all right.
He's a good friend of ours. He's been doing the show for a long time. And honestly, I really appreciate you being here. Crop Sciences.
Yes, it is. Department of Crop Sciences.
Department of Crop Sciences. All right. I'm going to have that tattooed on my arm here so the next time you're here, we get that right.
Not that I'm going to say anything, but you mentioned something like getting that changed last time I was on. But that's
yeah,
all right.
I know. I know. And it's very, I knew you would remember. And
the
we
TV
would,
site isn't any better. Don't worry about it.
Okay. Department of Crop Sciences, University of Illinois. The important thing, folks, is that if you have a bug problem, you call us.
Yeah,
and he'll tell you how to take care of it. All right. And in fact, we do have some other folks here. Real quick, let me ask you about an email question. Somebody knew had heard a previous, maybe it was in fact the last time you were here, talking about bed bugs, and said that you had mentioned particularly these products, Interceptor and Protect-A-Bed. Mm-hmm. I think these are these things that you sit the the feet of the bed in so the bugs don't climb up. They want to know about two other things. Are you familiar with something called Stop Bugging Me and something called Scram? You know about those?
I'm not familiar with either of those. My guess is that those may be pyrethroid insecticides that are labeled. I'm not really certain what those are. The Protect-A-Bed are essentially cups that are put underneath the they're called Protect-A-Bed is essentially a covering that goes over mattresses and box springs, and they have locking zippers so that the zippers don't work open and allow bed bugs to get inside of that protecting cover. And so this is an effective way that you can eliminate bed bugs hiding in various parts, particularly underneath parts of the box springs more than the mattress. Mm-hmm. There are lots of places there. So that's a very effective, useful thing. The other thing is called Climb Up Interceptor, which are cups that are put underneath the bedstead, and the bed is situated to be away from the wall, so it's not touching the wall. And that allows, then the only way the bed bugs can get to you outside of maybe dropping off the ceiling, which they rarely do, is climb up the bedstead legs. And in this situation, there's an area that's got fabric on it, allows them to climb up very easily into a moat, which is coated with talc that doesn't allow them to then get to the bedstead itself. So it's effective trap for bed bugs. And so if you have your mattresses and bed springs protected from the with a Protect-A-Bed and the climb up interceptors, and you have been careful to get rid of them in the cracks and crevices of your bedstead, theoretically they can't really get to you.
Yeah. Okay.
And they get kind of hungry that way.
All right.
Which is a good thing.
Hope that helps. And we will continue with some folks who are listening here on the telephone. The next caller is in Bloomington, I believe, line number one. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
I was wondering if you could tell us about the periodic cicadas, where they are now, and where they will be. Are they going to be moving on to new places soon?
Well,
I'm going to listen on the radio.
Okay. Thanks.
Periodic cicada, we had a 13-year brood come out in the southern, it's called the Great Southern Brood. And in Illinois, it extends as far north as northern Sangamon County in the central part of the state and goes upwards a little farther north, a couple counties on both the east and western sides of the state. Nationally, and then it goes south through Illinois, with the exception of a few counties in the southern parts of the state near the Wabash and Ohio and Mississippi rivers. It's throughout the rest of the state through the south. And then extends on through Kentucky, Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama. This is an exceedingly large brood that's come out. We just happen to be at the northern edge of it, northwestern edge of it, actually. That has been out for a number of weeks. They first showed up around the third week in May and have been present, and the males have been singing. They are not going to move to anywhere else this year. They are where they are. And are not going to be anywhere else. So if you haven't heard the singing, you don't have them. And there are areas of the southern half of the state that do not have them because of the trees having been eliminated sometime over the last few hundred to couple thousand years and killing all the cicadas that were living on the roots underneath. So right now, late last week, visited an infestation or a hive number near Decatur. And the males were dying off, which means that the singing's about to stop. When the males die, they're the singers. The females still hang on, and were actively laying eggs at that time. They insert them into the stems of a plant. And I just got back from a trip to Tennessee, and in northwestern Kentucky, you could see lots of damage associated with their egg laying. We got a sample just yesterday on damage from Effingham, and what they will do is they will insert their eggs in the stems of trees and shrubs, and usually within a foot or so of the end of the stem, and those stems, well, if there's enough egg laying, the leaves will die and turn brown. The stems will tend to get broken off or fall and hang or fall to the ground. And so this is common, and we will see this repeatedly in the areas where the cicadas were singing over the next several weeks. And this damage is not important to an established tree or shrub. They will survive that well, but we are recommending that people protect young trees and shrubs, particularly young trees. Shrubs will regenerate from root systems. Trees will not. You could have enough egg laying that the trunk could snap off. So if you have a tree that has a trunk diameter of less than 2 inches, we recommend putting hardware cloth around the trunks, having it set off from the trunk so the cicadas can't reach it, and have it very tight towards the, particularly at the base, but at the top as well. A cicada on the ground will tend to walk upwards and will just walk underneath your, if it walks underneath a hardware cloth at the base, it'll just climb up the trunk and lay its eggs on it. So this is an effective and protectant. We're not recommending any insecticide applications. Insecticides will kill large numbers of cicadas, but research shows that it makes very little difference on the amount of damage to the trees. So so this is something that you need to be on top of.
All right. We have a number of callers here. Our guest is Phil Nixon. You have insect pest problems in the home or in the yard, call us and we'll get to them. The lines are full here. I want to take enough time here to remind people again that we're raising money to support the programs on the station. This is just day two of for us, which is only going to be 2 days, and I think we'll be doing a little bit more, but it's just a very short drive we're doing, and the reason we're doing it now is we're coming close to the end of our fiscal year. It's InSight. That's the end of the month, and we need to have the money for next year's programs in the bank at that point. So we wanted to take one more opportunity here to remind you that you can make a call, you can go online and support the station. Here in studio with me is Debbie Hamlet. She's our Director of Development. I want to mention the book giveaway one more time. When we've done this in the past, sometimes we've actually been talking about books, and so here we're talking about bugs, but this is another thing that we're just doing to
nice to be here,
encourage people to make a pledge.
Yeah, you make a pledge anywhere from $40 up, and you get a book from the Focus Library. You can tell the operator which category you want, fiction or nonfiction. That's the only kind of separation of books that we've got. Plenty of books that get sent to David for review. And so it's a good collection. It's a nice way to build up your library and support your station at the same time. And you can make your pledge by going to willpledge.org or call 217-244-9455. Today we're talking about bugs, and I see you've got a nice little book called Wicked Bugs there. We're not giving away that book.
That was a little present for Phil. We try to say we have certain things and we have guests on. We know that they're interested in those subjects, and we also have, it's a lovely gift for
it
people
is.
That are here on the show.
It is. I like that. But right now we're asking for you to make your pledge of support for this show, for Focus Every Day. It brings you any number of topics from bugs to investments earlier to all kinds of things in the area. And since I'm new here, relatively new, a couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks, this is a good place for me to find out about the area and what goes on in the region. And so I've appreciated being able to listen and find out what's of interest to the community. And we want to say thanks to Sarah from, help me out with the name here, Kankakee?
Kankakee.
Kankakee. I knew I was going to mess that up. And thanks to Brian from Chenoa.
Chenoa.
Yeah, that's okay, right. And Svetlana from Urbana. Oh, I know I have.
You got that one right.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. One out of three.
We'll give you a little tutorial later in local place names.
I know I shouldn't have tried that, but I'm
same
jumping
thing.
Right
if
in
we
there.
Had gone to South Carolina, we would have no idea how people would pronounce the names of their towns.
That's right. And so I want to hear from a lot of you, and everybody has been so warm and welcoming here, and your pledge really does count. And I'm new here, and I want to be able to hear from as many of you as possible. This is a valuable resource, a variety of issues that are important to you, and it's been on for over 30 years?
Yes, we just a little over 30. We passed our 30-year anniversary. It was in February.
Wow, and you look so young, David.
Well, I have this picture in the attic. It looks really bad. And I was 12 when I started doing the
that's
show.
That's right.
It was that program we have trying to attract youth into broadcasting.
But when you call now, you'll get a choice of a book, $40 and above, and you'll get a choice of a book, a fiction or a nonfiction book, And one that's been sent to David for review. So yeah. They're good books.
They're good things. They're hardcover books. They're recently published. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of things that have to do with politics and history and social issues and current issues. We do also get some novels. We don't do a lot of novelists on the show sometimes. But we love books. We love people who sell them, who write them, who publish them. We're all about the book. And we have many of them. And we just thought, well, that would be yet one other way. Maybe we could motivate somebody to make the pledge.
It's a nice idea.
Yeah,
you're listening already. You already value the show, so you're going to get a little extra thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Debbie. And one more time, we'll give the number. We'll confuse people because we're given so many numbers here. But if you want to make a pledge, 217-244-9455. You can go online too, wellpledge.org, and make the pledge. Here in the studio with me is Phil Nixon. He's an entomologist in the Department of Crop Sciences. And he's here, has for a long, long time, has been very generous several times throughout the year. He's on the program to answer questions about dealing with pest problems. So if you have a bug, it's in the house, it's in the yard, in your garden, just tell us what it is, give us the best description, and we'll tell you how to deal with it. We have several callers, and we'll go next to, let me see, Matt Toon, I do believe, on line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question regarding ants. Mm-hmm. I think like this year we had a high amount of them both inside the house and outside all over the place, and tried to control them in one part of the house where they were in the kitchen area, and they seemed to be all over things. Put down the combat little tablet container down there.
Okay.
They just ignored that for a long period of time, so then I got some taro ant bait.
Mm-hmm.
They went right for it, dead heavy for, say, 3-4 days, and then they just kind of backed off and didn't be as highly interested as they were before. And then they come back and they'd feed again, whatever. And they just didn't seem to want to kill them. So I put a second one down and kind of the same deal. They had on it real heavy reel for a day or two, and then they ignored it, but never could really control them. And they ended up getting more ants in the house. They ended up taking them out to tear out, and then it seemed like they kind of left that area and didn't come back.
Okay. What will happen is we would have had a lot of more ants problems this spring because of two things. One is that they will come into houses associated with the heat of a house warming up the soil and the nest next to a house, but it's too cold outside for them to forage. They don't forage outdoors at temperatures below 50 degrees Fahrenheit, not really very active at those low temperatures. And so what will happen is that they will come in under those type of situations. As it warms up more outside, there's more food outside, they tend to go outside and abandon the house. And so that commonly happens towards the latter part of May. However, in this year, we had some protracted cold spells or a returning cold spell, which probably would have caused them to come in more. They also have a tendency to come in more if the soil around the house is wetter, and so with all our rain, that could also have increased the situation. There are some ants, particularly odorous house ant, which is a common ant that will nest either in the house itself or out in the soil near the house, that commonly comes in and changes what it's interested in feeding on. We get people that call me up and they talk about, well, I've got grease ants or I got sugar ants. Actually, all ants are both for the most part, and depending on what they're doing in their colony. If they're raising young, they're interested in protein, i.e. grease, and will be attracted to protein-type foods. If they're primarily looking to try to feed the adults in the colony who feed on sweet materials, hence the name sugar ants, they will come to sweet baits. And so combat ant bait is a protein bait, will be attractive to grease ants, so to speak. And Antero ant bait and Grant's ant bait are two leading sweet baits or sugar baits that will be attractive to sweet feeding ants. And so in your case, they came and started feeding on the sugar, on the sweet baits, the Antero ant bait. And then when they quit doing that, probably the thing to have done would have been to put down the combat ant bait, because chances are good they were now looking for protein and they would have been attracted to it. That doesn't always happen. But particularly if you have odorous house ants, they will vacillate back and forth almost, it seems like, on a daily basis on the type of bait they're interested in. Other ants that come into the house are not near as, don't change their interest as much. So that would have probably been a good clue. they would have eventually left as it warmed up. And so I would suggest that that you be a little quicker on changing between the two different types of bait, combat ant bait for the protein or grease type, and taro or grass ant bait for the sweet feeding.
Now, they were both out at the same time.
Okay.
Same area.
And in another situation, they may have actually been finding some other food sources, which is also important to try to make sure that they're not finding something else that they might be able to feed on some stored potatoes or something of that nature that they might have found, or some dropped food elsewhere that they might have been able to get into. So these are also features associated with it. But sometimes the ants will go for a while not going after any particular bait, and then all of a sudden will start going to one of the baits they were ignoring just a few days before. So it takes a little bit of luck, a little bit of skill, and a lot of persistence many times to control ants.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right, thanks. We certainly had the same problem that we talked a little bit before we got going here, and I think, indeed, what we have is odorous house ants.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that for quite a few years now, they show up every year in the spring, mm-hmm. in basically about the same place.
Right.
And so we put out the baits, and I had thought that in the past that they worked, or maybe it's just at some point they just stopped coming.
It's a combination of both. Sometimes they work, sometimes they just decide to go elsewhere.
But I was sort of perplexed because by this time in the year, it seems generally you didn't see them anymore.
Yeah.
But they're amazingly persistent.
Yes, they are.
Well, we'll go on here. We'll talk next with someone in McLean County, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have several questions. I'm going to try to cut them down and maybe keep them short. One of them is that I put down bears complete in the garden, in the yard, to get rid of the grubs. It supposedly has everything for grubs and fleas and you name it.
Yeah, it's probably got imidacloprid in it.
It has what in it?
Probably imidacloprid or imidacloprid.
Okay.
That's all right.
I think.
That broad spectrum, that's probably what it is.
Okay. How often can you repeat that?
Generally, the application is one time a year.
Really?
If you look on the bag, it will indicate how much can be applied per year. And generally, when you're doing a grub-type application, which is a relatively high application, it is you're restricted to once a year on that.
Okay.
Now, there are other products that are out there on the market for grubs that would be different chemicals based in it. You look under the active ingredient, see what the chemical is. Mm-hmm. Look for one in a garden center that has a different chemical in it, and then it should be fine to be applied. But if it's what I think it is, imidacloprid is limited to on a high application rate, which is what it would be for grubs, once a year.
Okay, so what if I want to put something down for fleas? Because unfortunately, my dog's got fleas.
Well, our recommendation for fleas is first you need to have, it's going to be most effective in mowed areas where you don't have too much grass to try to, and other material to get through. But carbaryl sowed is 7 as a single application normally knocks down the flea population in the yard for a year. It doesn't eliminate them for that long. It doesn't last that long. But it normally gets it down to where it's not a problem for a year.
Carbaryl?
C-A-R-B-A-R. YL, and it will be sold under the trade name of 7, S-E-V-I-N.
Oh, okay. I use 7 for the vegetable garden stuff.
Yes, it's the same compound, only here you're probably going to want to have
a liquid form.
Yeah, you're probably using a dust there, and here you'd want to use a liquid form. Exactly right.
Okay. And how about those lovely flies that have shown up? I was trying to hang clothes yesterday, and there were like 2, 3, 4 different kinds of flies.
I'm not sure which ones you're talking about, but if they're about 1/4 inch long, they're probably either blowflies or houseflies.
Uh-huh.
And with our rain and decaying organic matter, high temperatures, that is probably what they are. And they're just they're going to be living in decaying organic matter and have had enough time to come out as adults. The cool weather that we've had previously would have held them back, so now they may be coming out more numerous. They will tend to reduce gradually over time because various other critters will eat them and knock down their numbers.
Uh-huh. Going back real quickly, and then I'll make sure I'm done. The 7,
uh-huh.
Liquid 7, you said we need to do one-time application?
One-time application.
And should last us for a year?
Well, it lasts actually only about 7 to 10 days, but it will provide protection for a year. The fleas that come into your yard primarily are due to being dropped off of wild animals and wildlife that come through the yard. And generally, they don't have near as many fleas as domestic dogs or dogs will have. And so it takes a while for them to build up in a yard after you've knocked them back. So
all those rabbits and squirrels are bringing them in.
Yes, but they tend to be relatively low infestation of the cat flea, which is what's going to attack your dogs and cats. The squirrels have their own flea, which is not a problem. The rabbits have their own flea, which is not a problem. And so generally, the number of fleas that are brought in from wildlife, but it's a relatively small number, which means that it takes a number of weeks to months for those numbers to build up. And so although the seven doesn't last near a year, it provides protection for a year because it just takes that much longer. It takes a long time for the fleas to build back up.
What do you do at home? I didn't mean to ask you another question, but what would you recommend to do inside the house?
For fleas, the best recommendation and what we'd use ourselves in our own house with our own pets are the spot applications,
right.
the applications that you apply to the bare skin between the shoulder blades of your pet and provide several weeks of control. And so here you're actually, to a certain extent, treating the bait. You're using your dog as bait in this situation, and they will effectively eliminate the fleas in a house by protecting the pets.
But you don't do anything for the carpet. You don't use the bug balm or whatever.
We do recommend application of a carpet if a person has fleas that does not have pets. But if they have pets, normally the application to the pet is by far the most effective and least amount of insecticide used. And these have been tested thoroughly for safety to the pet as well. So you're using less insecticide, being more direct and specific in controlling the pests than doing a carpet application.
Okay, great. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Right, thanks. I think that for some time now the vets have been recommending that as opposed to the old flea collars, the things that
right.
people used to use.
Yeah, the flea collars protect the collar area. and it takes a very small pet for them to protect the rest of the pet. So particularly for somebody who is applying a topical material, a flea powder, for instance. Many pets will not want to have a flea powder applied around their face and head, and so the collar is an effective way of controlling the fleas there, whereas you may be able to use a powder elsewhere on the pet. Some people, the drop-on applications are relatively expensive, and so some people shy away from spending that kind of money on their pet. However, compared to applying to the carpets in the house and the upholstered furniture and the cracks and crevices, et cetera, it's relatively inexpensive.
Maybe about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus. Phil Nixon is our guest. He's an entomologist at the University of Illinois in the Department of Crop Sciences. His special area is dealing with insect pest problems around the home. And if you got a problem, call us, and he'll tell you what to do about it. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Up next is Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
We have ants in our house, but we also have a small child, so we cannot put those ant bait things. Is there some spice or something that we can put down that will not kill the child but kill the ants?
The baits that I recommend although you don't want to have a child eating it, they are normally inside bait stations that are exceedingly difficult for a child to get into. It's not that they can't, but it would take some tools to get into that material, to get to that bait material. And then the other side of a coin is to place the bait in areas that are out of reach of the child but within reach of the ant. In other words, the ants get into much smaller crevices than even your child's hand can reach into. And so many times by considering where the baits are placed and using some thought that direction, you can come up with ideas of where you can put them, behind counters, inside, and in the back of cabinets, et cetera, out of, not in the areas where food or dishes are being stored, but underneath some of those shelves and so on, areas that the ants are coming to that really your child has really no access to. And so with some thought, you can place these in areas where the child just cannot reach them. These materials, by the way, if you're concerned about exposure otherwise, these materials that I'm recommending are used commonly in nursing homes, hospital emergency rooms, hospital patient rooms, pet stores, various places where people are much, much more susceptible to insecticides than the general population. And so they have almost no release into the environment from volatility, odors, et cetera. So I think that with some thought, you can find places to use these and still have them out of reach of your children.
Okay. What is it you recommend?
We recommend combat ant bait and these come in bait stations. That's the only way you can buy it.
Okay.
That for protein bait, grease feeding ants, and either Grant's ant bait or Taro ant bait, which also come in prepared stations. Not all the Taro does, but you can find them that way. That are for sweet ants that are going towards sweet baits.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And again, for any, and this, I know this just gets kind of confusing for people who hadn't heard some of our earlier conversation. One of the points that you always make is that at different times, the same ant may be attracted to the different baits. So
right.
if you really wanted to have all your bases covered, you should have a protein bait and a sweet bait, both. And I guess you can put them both out or, see.
I prefer putting them out
consecutively,
but one could put them out together. Generally what you've got is the directions will be is you put them where the ants are trailing. And so you have limited places where you can put these baits and have them go across the trail where the ants are coming and going. And so generally what I would recommend is to put out probably the combat ant bait first and to see if they come to that. If they don't, then replace it with a Grant's or a Taro as a sweet bait.
Okay.
And so putting out both together is not necessarily going to be as practical considering the logistics of getting the bait in the right place.
All right. A couple of Indiana callers. I believe they're both Terre Haute. We'll go to first line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hello. Good afternoon.
Hi.
We have, particularly bad this year, tiny little gnats or flies, and I've heard them called buffalo gnats.
Okay. These are biting gnats, I take it.
They are. They're nasty, and they raise welts.
Okay.
And they bite you. And I don't think there's anything I could do to get rid of them, but does, like, off or something like that?
Well,
keep them away from you, or is there anything which I can do to get rid of them?
The good news is that they have probably about run their course. The bad news is they will probably be back next year. These are buffalo gnats, sometimes called black flies, the larvae live in most of them live in clear flowing streams. And we've seen a resurgence in recent years in the Midwest from these, and I think probably due to the water getting cleaner than it used to be. We're not polluting our water systems as much as we used to. We're not putting as much silt in our water systems as we used to. There's been a change of public ethic concerning polluting water, and I think that's done more than some laws like the Clean Water Act have done. When people just decide this is not a good thing to do, it happens better than all the laws put together. And so many environmental advocacy groups will admit that in many areas of the country, the water is cleaner than it used to be. And I think this is allowing these insects to develop and become a problem when we probably haven't had them most recently, probably in the 1920s or 30s, before we got our water as polluted as we did through the balance of the 20th century. So that's the reason why they'll be back. The best effective materials that we know about to control them are going to be the insect repellents. However, for many people, the insect repellents are not particularly effective, those containing DEET or other materials, picaridin and so on, that you buy as offer cutters and these sorts of brands. Try those and see if they work. If they don't, they're not working for you. there have been various other types of home remedy type things. Those have been tested and been found to be, for the vast majority of the population, less effective than the commercial repellents for buffalo gnats. Bottom line is, if you do a lot of work outside, they're not going to bite through clothing like mosquitoes will. They only bite to exposed skin, so long sleeves, gloves, and many people will invest in hats that have netting that protect your face and shoulders and so on.
Because that's the worst. My wife got that next to her eye.
Yeah. So.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah. So. And if you're getting bit a lot by buffalo gnats, they don't just go in like a hypodermic needle like a mosquito will. They slash and lap, and so you can actually have blood running down your off your face and so on from several bites from these. So they get rather impressive looking as well, and you get swelling from them. So they are something that we need to cope with. They're typically out. Typically, there's only one species that is going to bite people that's dominant, and they normally are out for 2 to 3 weeks. We've had them for about 3 weeks, so we've got to be very close to them ending now. And in the future, you kind of have to realize that this is the time of year they're out. And my suggestion is you don't have middle of the day outdoor functions during this time of the year, because in areas where they tend to be a problem, you just have to change your way of doing things. There's nobody that's ever going to allow you to pollute the water again to kill a buffalo gnat. So.
I wouldn't advise that.
No.
It seems that I'm a couple miles from the river here, and there's no streams around.
Yeah.
I was just surprised that there's so many of them in the neighborhood. They must get around pretty good.
Yeah, they will fly as much as 15 miles, commonly 7 miles. So, you can get them even though you're not very close to their source, and it's just something that we end up having to cope with.
Thank you for your time.
All right. You're welcome.
Thank you. On to another Terre Haute person here, line number one on somebody on cell phone. Hello.
Hello. I don't know whether it's me or not.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Oh, good. I was told line four and jumped in before. Thank you very much for taking my call. I'd like to compliment your guest on his coverage. Mine isn't strictly a household question. But I understand that moths are a bat's feet on the moths of certain insect species that attack cucumbers. And I wondered whether your guest knew whether the same insect species also attack melon crops.
The only thing that I can think of is our most serious pests associated with cucumbers are going to be cucumber beetles, which will transmit cucurbit wilt, which is a disease, a bacterial disease that will kill off the cucumber plants. I'm not aware of any moths that are major problems associated with cucumbers. We get a little bit of squash vine borer attacking them, much more so on squash. This is primarily a day-flying moth, which is probably not impacted near as much by bats as other types of moths would be. Cutworm moths, for instance, would have large moths that fly at night that would be much more impacted by bat predation than the squash vine borer, which is a wasp-like looking insect. It mimics a wasp and thus flies during the daytime when wasps fly. Otherwise, you don't have a very good mimic if you're not out at the same time. So they are, I'm not aware of the major pests associated with vine crops that would be, the adult stage would be a night-flying moth that bats would have much of an impact on.
How about other commercial crops whose adults might be preyed on by bats?
Certainly the cutworms that I mentioned previously, armyworm, the European corn borer, and the armyworm feeds on small grains primarily, will also feed on corn. Cutworm is a major problem on a wide range of different types of crops. And so in certain areas, particularly in Texas, where you have the Mexican free-tailed bat, which occurs in very huge numbers and is exceedingly insectivorous, they have found that the bat colonies, the Mexican free-tailed bats in Texas, are a major factor in reducing pests, field crop pests, in that particular part of the country. in Illinois, Indiana, and the Midwest, we tend to have our dominant species are going to be big brown bat, little brown bat, pipistrelle, red bat, these sorts of bats, which, although they are insectivorous, normally don't build up to very high populations, and so it's generally assumed that their impact on the moths are not as great as they would be in some other parts of the country, simply due to lack of bat numbers in order to make that much of an impact on the population. Certainly they are making an impact, but probably not as great as you may read about on the Internet or in various types of publications.
You're at the University of Illinois Entomology Department?
I'm in the University of Illinois Crop Sciences Department.
If I were to direct an email to you, would it be too much trouble to direct me towards some information in this regard?
No, that would be fine. And my email address is easily found online under University of Illinois. It's just pnixon@illinois.edu.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
Mm-hmm. All right, very good. And we'll see real quick, go one more. Georgetown, line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Have you got me?
Yes.
Okay. Couple questions. I just started listening about 10, 15 minutes ago, so you maybe already answered it. I was working in the yard, and my question was, do we have a different kind of mosquito out there? Because I got the hugest welts I've ever had. But after you talked about the buffalo gnat, do they cause large welts also?
On some people, they do. And so my guess is that since you have not experienced those kind of welts previously, and buffalo gnats have only been around in fairly high numbers for the last 3 or 4 years in various areas and are becoming numerous in some areas they haven't been previously in the last couple of 3 years, that's probably what you're being exposed to. Some people will swell up quite a bit from them.
I did have insect repellent on. I had used the cutter. I've never seen. I mean, I always affected by mosquitoes, so I put the insect repellent on, but these were huge welts. Just a home remedy type thing. A friend told me that she had heard to put vanilla, and so I just put dabs of vanilla on my face, and it did seem to help. Just a home remedy on those gnat type thing.
Yeah, some people, a lot of it depends on what your genetic makeup is. That's also right. Why some people swell up more to the bites than others. It's your genetics. Some people, vanilla works well for. For more people, it does not work at all for. So it depends.
I must jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. We're just at that point where we're going to have to stop because we've used our time. Phil, I'm sure maybe a little later in summer we'll come back. In the meantime, if you have this kind of question, look in the phone book and find out what your nearest extension person is. They can often help you with that.
It will be listed underneath your county name or University of Illinois.
All right. Phil Nixon is an extension specialist, deals with pest problems. He's in the Department of Crop Sciences. Occasionally he's here on the program to answer questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.